Hello, and welcome to episode 12 of The Winning Agenda. Tonight, our panelists include runner-up for both the 2014 Melbourne Regionals and the 2014 Australian Nationals, Liam Prasad,
Hey there, guys.
two-time store champion and three-time Magic the Gathering Pro Tour competitor, Wilfie Horrig,
How's everyone doing today?
2014 Australian National Champion and 2014 World's Top 16 competitor, Jesse Marshall.
Oh, it's great to be here in the festive season, Brian.
And 2014 World's Top 8 competitor, Dave Hoyland.
Hiya.
Before we begin, we'd just like to give a quick shout out to Zach, Stephen, and the guys at Team Covenant. They got in contact with us earlier this week and have gotten into the Christmas spirit by deciding to send us all some of their newly released click trackers. Honestly, it's hard to express how kind this is, receiving a gift from a much bigger company than us from the other side of the globe, just in recognition for the content we're putting out is really lovely and certainly the best present we could have asked for this Christmas. We thought we'd start the conversation today with just Dave giving us a rundown of his experience at Worlds. We've got him visiting us from the UK via the power of the internet. So, Dave, how was Worlds for you? Your trip to Minnesota and everything went well?
Yeah, very
obviously,
good.
Obviously, top eight?
Yeah, that was a little bit unexpected, but very pleasing. I think, for me, the main thing was I was a bit down on Worlds. Wasn't sure if I actually wanted to go. And having been, it's probably been like one of the best experiences I've ever had. Anyone ever thinks about going to Worlds, I'd highly recommend it.
Excellent. And in terms of like how the tournament went, did you have any interesting encounters, or that was the matter of what you thought it was going to be?
So I teched very heavily against Near Earth Hub, which turned out to be the right call, since of the 8 games against Corp I played, 7 of them were against Near Earth Hub, and then the other one was against Jinteki Personal Evolution. The meta was exactly what I was expecting it to be.
And what decks did you take to the tournament?
I've been playing Andromeda for most of kind of tournament season, so I continued along with that, but I've been playing a Parasite-heavy version of Andromeda. In testing against Near Earth Hub, just it couldn't deal with it because of lack of multi-access cards such as R&D interface, and because it just didn't have the card draw it needed. So I ended up taking Andromeda with R&D interface, and then the economy and card draw fueled by John Massanorian's security testing. Once it was kind of designed so that once it was set up, which you could do very quickly with Desperado security testing and John Massanori, one click was 3 credits and a card and possibly a data sucker counter, and that allowed kind of the other 3 clicks just to be used on kind of aggression.
So did you end up cutting the parasites completely from the list?
So in testing, I found that RP was a serious problem for the deck, and so in the end, what I decided to do was go for 2 R&D interface and 2 parasite, which meant I was running 1 Corrodo and 1 Breach as my backup. RP still wasn't a good matchup. Not that it ended up mattering, but since I didn't play any RP.
So on the runner side, you felt quite confident throughout the tournament? You felt like your games went pretty well as runner?
It's hard to tell. So in the Swiss, I won 5 of my 6 runner games. It was actually my Corp in the Swiss that let me down. In the top 16, I lost both of my runner games and won both of my Corp games. But even in the top 16 games, I felt that the runner deck was really strong. I had an awful starting hand against Spags in my first game, and in the other runner game, the deck's designed to tag me, so I was taking tags from Siphon and John Massanori, and my opponent played a one-off closed accounts when I was at 20 credits. So he was.
Yeah,
playing.
I think I was commentating for your wife at that moment, and I didn't really know how to break that news to her.
How to break
yeah.
it to her. In general, how did you find the tag me strategy across the day? You played a lot of Near Earth Hub, so it didn't come up too much. Did you ever want, because your deck, as you said, is fueled by the economy of security testing, did that become prohibitive the longer the game went?
Not really. I felt that the Corp was generally under so much pressure because that they didn't really stop to destroy things like security testing or John Massanori. And if they did, actually, it was such a tempo hit to them that it kind of just allowed me a more dominant board position.
And on the Corp side, what did you prepare for with your Corp deck? And I know that you were running Scorched Earth in a Near Earth Hub. Yeah. How did that work out against the metagame, and why did you decide to make that call?
Again, I was expecting a lot of Near Earth Hub, so I decided that everyone would expect the Astrobiotics version, and I was hoping that people would play quite recklessly, trying to be aggressive against Near Earth Hub and therefore would allow me to get easy flatline kills. That was my kind of decision making there. In Swiss, the Corp deck won 3 of the 6 games, and all of them by agenda points, though the threat of flatline was definitely a contributing factor. And then in the top 16, it won both its games by a flatline.
They should have scouted you out by the sounds of it, seeing you on the top tables on the way into the top eight.
Oh, there was an anti-scouting decree, so.
Oh, interesting.
Really? I didn't know that happened at Worlds. How was that police just at a
curiosity? They just said when you're done with your match, leave the room. Because there was heaps of space in the tournament center, so you didn't have to stay in the room.
Oh, okay.
Wow, cool.
They asked people not to scout. That's correct, isn't it, Dave? I certainly got that impression.
I didn't have kind of anything where, you know, people were coming over to watch games or anything like that. So people were really, really good with scouting and things like that. So yeah, no problems at all with that.
In general, Dave, you were talking about the event itself and why you enjoyed it and why you'd recommend it to other people. What are some of the things that contributed to that?
The people is definitely one of the big things. Everyone who I met there, obviously, you know, the reason I'm here is because I met Jesse there, and everyone was really nice, really friendly, just wanted to talk about Netrunner and the strategy and the meta game and kind of the new cards that are coming out. Even kind of, you know, the fact it's Worlds, I didn't play against anyone who was horrible to play against, you know, was calling over judges or anything like that. It was all really friendly, lots of banter, you know, it was just a great experience. The organisation was very good. You know, probably a little dated, they were still putting up the pairings on pieces of paper, which I find quite entertaining, when they had huge projectors putting the time up of the rounds. You know, all the staff were really helpful, and it was really good to get a chance to talk to people like Lucas about kind of, you know, why various decisions have been made about things like the tournament structure and various other things. So the community really does make it.
Yeah, it was sort of nice to see the online community. It was sort of a lot of names that you might see in internet forums talking about the game, and you were able to put a face to a name at the tournament, I guess, which was nice, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I spent a lot of time talking to people like Jesse Vandover, Spags, Elad. They're really prominent in the Netrunner community, and you never know what people are like based on kind of online, but really nice guys.
You had a good result in the winter tournament the night before the main event too, didn't you? Do you want to talk us through that and how that helped to prepare you for the main event?
I was playing Andy, and I was playing HB, so slightly different decks. This was, they call it a side event, which makes me laugh, since I think it was 84 people, which is kind of bigger than any tournament that's taken place for Netrunner in the UK. So it was four rounds of Swiss, and after those four rounds, I was undefeated with seven wins and a timed win. That was only enough for me to finish in second place to Jesse Vandover on strength of schedule.
It was a bit disappointing for you finishing second, wasn't it, considering the prize split at the end?
Yeah, the first place prize was an Alt Art Eli, which is something I don't have, which is, so yeah.
Yeah, and what did you end up with, a Wayland ID or something?
I think I got a Wayland ID, a Plazcrete, and an Alt Art Melange, which I already got full set.
Oh, that's not too bad.
That's some cool stuff. Yeah, that melange is very sexy.
Yeah, one thing that is worth shouting out to FFG at this point, I guess, as well, is how much prize support they did put up for those side events. Even for the draft, they put up those uncut sheets of Genesis Cycle stuff, which is pretty gas.
And just briefly back on developments that we've heard about towards the judge program FFG is putting together, I'm actually really excited about that. I know that new players tend to not necessarily like calling judges. They think it's a bit of bad form, but having judges in the room is fantastic, and being able to register as a judge or pass a test as a judge, I think it's going to be really good for the state of the game in local stores.
Yeah, we did have like Damon and Lucas both judging on the floor on the day. A couple of instances where we had to call them over, and it was definitely good to have people who knew the game back to front who could help clear up those little things that come up every now and then in the game, little confusions. So it definitely made the event a lot smoother to have good judges there.
Moving on, we're going to let Dave take us through a deck tech on one of his personal HB Glacier builds. So Dave, can you take us through the concept of the deck and how you go about playing it?
It's set up to be a very kind of standard HB Glacier build. So it's got a lot of big taxing ice, and it's got a lot of economy. Because it's Glacier, it's also got a very low agenda density. It's running 4/5/3s. Because of that, you know, it sounds kind of quite a standard kind of HB Glacier deck. The thing which makes it very, I suppose, unique, special, cool, is it's running Punitive Counter-Strikes as part of its Influence Splash, and it has a lot of recursion, so it's running Project Vitruvius, and it's running Archive Memories to allow kind of a double strike with those cards. The influence goes on only three different cards. So there's three Jackson Howards in the deck, there's three punitive counterstrikes, and there's three toll booths. The reason the deck has been doing so well for me lately, so it's won me a couple of local tournaments, and also, as I was saying earlier, it went undefeated in the 84-person World Side event. So the reason it's so strong is because it's so taxing. So it's running the next ice, Itchies, Heimdalls, etc. So in order to get through the ice, it's really taxing on the runner. The other thing is it's got a huge amount of economy, hedge funds, restructures, successful demonstrations, Eve campaigns, Melange Mining Corps. It's able to res all of this really expensive ice, and it's also very strong at getting a significant credit lead over the runner because of especially things like Melange Mining Corp. It's you're able to get that up and running for a couple of turns, and you know it turns on all the big ice and the flatline. So,
and how do you find in the early game defending your central servers, Dave? What ice do you usually use for that, and how sort of safe do you feel in that early period?
The agenda density helps quite a lot. So only having eight agendas in the deck means that you're less likely to see a huge number of them early. Jackson Howard really is kind of in the deck to make sure that you can kind of you've got a better chance of recovering from a flood, or just kind of, you know, doing what Jackson Howard does and saving you from kind of a bad draw. The early game isn't actually as bad as you think because of there's a lot of cheap early game ice in the deck, such as the next bronzes, the next silvers, the Eli's, Architects, things like that. All of those things are great early game, but especially things like the next ice, unless they're running kind of Parasite Recursion, later on in the game it's even more kind of taxing, and therefore when you add on toll booths, Heimdalls, etc., it just becomes even more taxing for the runner.
How do you respond to a runner who sort of sits back and tries to accumulate resources and develop their rig? How do you put pressure on them early, and how do you later in the game secure a remote? Do you use Ash, or is there some other way that you try and do that?
Yep, I do indeed use Ash. So I'm running two Ash in the deck, and then there's Archive Memories for Recursion, usually for the punitive counterstrikes, but also for, you know, if the runner is running trashing Ash or running through an expensive server to trash Melange Mining Corp, sometimes I'll just get it back to put them under more pressure. So this, and actually Melange Mining Corp is probably one of the key cards in the deck. Unlike cards like Adonis Campaign, which the runner will often just leave to run, most runners will realize they have to get in and destroy a melange. So actually that forces them to make runs, and often they're very expensive runs.
So considering that you are playing so many asset-based pieces of economy, Dave, how do you balance that economy with scoring? Do you often have to build two centrals to keep your Adonis going or your Eve going while you score, or do you just usually score that late in the game?
I'm not running Adonis, I'm running melange instead, because I like to force runs on my remotes. Generally, I will either leave Eve out unprotected, depending on the runner, or you know, just a single piece of ice so that I can play asset economy in there and it will tax them to trash it a bit more. Melange will go in my scoring server, and then I will get rid of it once I've used it significantly and feel that I've got enough credits to res my ice, threaten a punitive or score. Mostly I only have one remote, possibly a second one for Eve. The deck normally doesn't score particularly early. The exception to that is I will often try and score a Project Vitruvius with a single counter on it in the early game if I have the opportunity, because as soon as I then draw a punitive counterstrike and have a good credit advantage, the theft of a single three-pointer is often fatal. Even the runner seeing punitive counterstrike sometimes helps, because they slow down, look for their plasma, try and gain a credit advantage, and things like that. So even the threat, it's like against Wayland, you know, the threat of the flatline slows people down.
And do you run any traps or ambushes or anything that can punish the runner for spending all their credits getting into your server and it's not actually an agenda?
No, not at all. So I kind of want them to make runs on my remote server. Ideally, I want to force them to trash the melange once I've had a use or two out of it, because it will cost them a lot of money to get in and do that, and that will give me a scoring opportunity. There's Ash, so providing I've got the credit advantage, often you'll find that they have to make two runs, or they will just have to trash the Ash or whatever that might be.
There's no, and then that opens up another scoring window the next turn itself, so that's good. Yeah.
So there's no traps. I'm sure a one-off Agsec would probably be great, but deck space is pretty limited, and I do worry, because obviously I'm running a number of assets, about what impact that has on kind of R&D accesses. While I'm not running traps, scoring a three-pointer isn't always a good thing for the runner. I'll give you an example. I had a game at Worlds. I was playing against Caleb from Bad Publicity, and he made a run on a server kind of with about three pieces of Next Dice and maybe a Tollbooth, and he had a choice. He could access the card, which was a three-point agenda, and I was on match point. If he did take it, he knew, because he'd seen the cards in my hand, I had a punitive counterstrike and had a scored Vitruvius. So if he took it, he died to punitive. If he didn't take it, I scored. And that's the strength of the deck, is putting kind of the runner in those sort of catch-22 situations. That was part of the reason I took NEH Scorch to Worlds, was that double threat. And the runner slowing down allows you to score that first Astro or that. So I think the double win condition is very strong at the moment.
Moving into our next segment, we wanted to talk about the concept of synergy versus power when deck building and how that can affect your decisions. Basically, you shouldn't go all in on one particular synergy at the cost of overall power. Wilfie, could you take us a bit deeper?
Yeah, so I've had this experience lately because I'm building a deck for basically the first time. I've been working on the Blue Sun mid-range list that Jesse posted a couple episodes ago, and it's been a foray into deck building for me. So normally I prefer net decks because I don't usually have the time and the experience necessary to make something on my own which is as good as what other people have done. That's usually a better way to go for me, but Blue Sun is new and quite unexplored, at least new for us, and so I figured I would give it a shot. And what inspired this topic to me is that I played some games with it. I played a couple tournaments, and the list started as a kind of more resource advantagey list, but that's not really the power of Blue Sun, in my opinion. I think that Blue Sun is good because it gives you flexibility in scoring out of remotes. So like a one or two iced remote can present a lot of possibilities because of the flexibility you have to play and recur your ice, even if it does come at some disadvantage in efficiency, because of course bouncing an ice and replaying it doesn't gain you credits or cards. And so because of those factors, I decided to cut the Seasource and the Scorched Earth, and I feel like a lot of people think that they're kind of sacred cows in the strategy, even though I find them to be not that good, and even though I found them in my games to be not that good. And conversely, I think that people often have the opposite idea, where they think that cards which are really good, they don't play because they think they don't fit with their deck, even though the cards are so powerful that it's worth it to try and fit them into your deck, even if it's at some cost to the vision of what you want to do. Like, I think I saw someone recently who decided to play an aggressive criminal deck trying to pressure their opponent's remotes, and the ID was Silhouette, but they weren't playing Siphon because they didn't think it would be useful enough at the time, even though, in my opinion, Siphon is so strong, it's one of the strongest runner cards, that it's worth diluting your strategy to try and make it as good as possible.
What you're saying to us, Wilfie, is that in your testing with Blue Sun, you found that even though Seasource and Scorched is one of the most powerful packages in the game, it wasn't able to work effectively and consistently within the Blue Sun shell that you were playing, and you felt that other cards that were more synergistic would be a better call in that situation. But there are some situations in which the converse is true, that cards that are more synergistic may not benefit your strategy as much as just playing the most powerful cards. And do you think that that's because Siphon is a powerful economy card, whereas Scorched and Seasource are powerful cards that require you to already have the resources? Is that the difference there?
Yeah, definitely one big part of it is that Seasource and Scorched requires a much deeper strategic commitment. That is to say, you need to have the ability to consistently have a credit lead over the runner, even if it leads to some lessening of some of your other positions, like your position on board or your ability to defend your remotes. And while it's not always the case that you need to have that for Scorched to be good, it definitely makes it a lot better.
Do we think this concept is reflected a little bit in a lot of the stealth lists we've seen lately? And stealth as a concept for a runner deck is a relatively new thing to the metagame. But for instance, one thing that I've seen often is there's a Kit stealth list obviously wants to exploit the power of Refractor as a powerful code gate breaker. So what a lot of these lists do is that they just go all in on stealth breakers across the board at a cost of overall power, because some of the stealth breakers are less efficient than a regular breaker, whereas you could just play the Refractor and say three copies of Ghost Runner, which are credits that can be spent on any kind of breaker, as well as pairing a Refractor.
When you play more and more silences and cloaks, and when you play more lockpicks, you don't actually get more synergy out of your breakers, because the limiting factor on how many times you can use your breaker per turn is obviously the stealth credits. But if you had just, say, a switchblade and a silencer, regular breakers around that. So instead what you're getting is an incredibly efficient breaker as part of a suite, whereas if you lean too far into the strategy, you're in fact diluting the power of your breaker suite by just honestly putting a limiting factor on it, which is having stealth credits.
Yeah, I played against a stealth deck today. Rob was playing a stealth deck at our local tournament, and he was playing Corroder instead of Black Cat. He was playing Refractor and Switchblade, and that was a very efficient rig. Once it got to the mid-game and he had a couple of stealth hardware to back up the Refractor and the Switchblade, he then had a Corroder, which is an efficient normal breaker, and he was able to get into any server. If he'd gone for the Black Cat as well, it would have taken him an extra one or two turns to set up to have enough stealth credits to use all of those stealth breakers, and that might have been the time that the Corp needed to, that I needed in that situation, to score some more points and put enough pressure on him to look at winning the game. As it was, his deck was fast enough to get at me just before I was set up, and those one or two turns can really be what makes the difference.
And it was because he found that balance between just raw powerful cards and cards that lead into the synergies of the particular strategy he's choosing to employ.
Yeah, exactly. I think that, just on the same note of stealth, that Refractor is the best because one cost, two strength, one to break, at, like, as a fixed breaker, is not that far off playable in some situations, and it's even closer to playable when you gain the ability to upgrade it the later the game goes, whereas I think it's really bad to require stealth credits for your breakers to do basically anything at all.
Yeah, especially with Quandary and Enigma being such popular code gates, Refractor is probably the one I'll choose to go for first.
I'm a very big fan of Switchblade. While it does require at least two stealth credits to power, sentries tend to be the most expensive ice to break, and for two reoccurring credits, effectively with silencers, or two Ghost Runner credits, you can break a sentry just for those credits, and things against cards such as Kamayu, Tsurugi, etc. Switchblade is very, very efficient. I think it comes back to what you were saying earlier, which is it's really good when paired with normal breakers. If you go all in just using the stealth breakers, or just that as your only sentry breaker, it's not very good.
I also did get the chance to play against Rob today, and he had the other Switchblade with silencers online, and I was playing just an RP list with some Quandaries and Paper Walls for the Sundews. In fact, what ended up happening was the Paper Walls and the Quandaries were possibly my most relevant ice for a large portion of the game, because if I ran out the Komainu or ran out the Tsurugi, he would just Switchblade straight through it, and you're paying 6 credits for his 0 once you consider that they recur. It was very good.
I think that one of the common mistakes probably newer players make with going all in on an idea is kind of with identities such as kind of Ian Sterling or Leela Patel. So with Ian Sterling, they think, right, well, I want to be behind on agenda points, so I'll use, you know, keyhole, so I never score until the end of all my 7 points until the end of the game. Or they'll use Leela and they'll use Logos because their ID ability already gives them something when the Corp scores. So by having Logos, they have that second ability. And in some decks, that might be right, but you shouldn't go all in on kind of an idea just because it tandems with something. It actually might be that Desperado or Boxy or something else is the better console for your deck, but people get stuck on the idea of, well, I want X, Y, and Z to happen when the Corp scores, or something like that. And a similar idea is with Kit and Paintbrush and only using code gate breakers. Sometimes you can go kind of too far with just kind of one idea in a deck, and actually it makes the deck worse.
because by the time you've installed a paintbrush and a code gatebreaker that's efficient enough, like a torch, you might as well have just played more efficient breakers and a whole rig, and you could still get in, and you can still use Kit's ability instead of trying to tailor your whole deck around it, like exactly like what you were saying with Leela. Instead of just getting that marginal benefit whenever you steal all the corp scores, that you're trying to get this massive benefit. Some people see Kit's ability and they think, well, I can build my whole deck around it, instead of seeing it as a slight benefit and a disadvantage to the corp only having a small number of ice on their servers. So yeah, I think there's definitely something to be said for not going too deep on the strategy of your ID ability and seeing it as a way of complementing the general strategy of getting in and stealing agendas.
And another example on the corp side we could take a look at is, in particular with the new card, the Hostile Infrastructure, and perhaps with the new Jinteki ability that stops, that raises the cost of all your cards being trashed. You know, there's a good chance that if you raise the cost of your trasher costs by 5 credits and then res the Hostile Infrastructure to deal them 1 more net damage, that marginal increase in cost won't have any effect, because there's a good chance the runner already decided that they didn't want to trash. 7 credits was too much for a Sundew or something like that already.
And if you'd included a better card instead of Hostile Infrastructure in your deck, maybe you'd get closer to actually winning the game at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, I think, sometimes when you do play so many cards that synergize well together, when you overdraw them, There is an upper bound on the amount that they can do. There is an upper bound on the power that you can generate from your combination of cards. And so if you just consistently draw more and more of those cards, you're not branching into new space in terms of what your deck is capable of, and you're not actually increasing the power level either, which is why it's good to have a variety of different effects and not lean too far into just one synergistic strategy, like preventing trashing of your cards.
That comes right back to our earlier discussion of what are the core things that a runner deck's trying to do, what are the core things a corp deck's trying to do. You don't want to compromise your ability to do those core things. You want to use your ID ability and all the cards in your deck to do those things better.
As a rule of thumb, the closer that what your strategy wants to do is to the core tenets of Netrunner that you want to efficiently get accesses, pressure the opponent both on the runner side and on the corp side, and score points quickly and build resources quickly, usually those are the things that are pushed. So trying to use tricks to bypass one of those situations, like not trying to score agendas until your opponent has 7 points in the bin, usually those strategies aren't as well developed, and you're losing a lot of power inherent in trying to do the things that the game naturally wants you to do.
Excellent. We'd also like to announce a competition. For your chance to win a winning agenda playmat, all you have to do is send us a deck list. We're then going to test some of the lists and do an exclusive deck tech on the winner.
If you think you've got a really great idea in an ID, whether it's a really interesting twist on Blue Sun or some sort of new personal evolution or replicating perfection deck that you think might be really competitive, then we'd be interested to give it a go. Or if you've got some tweaks, that small minor tweaks that you've made to an existing archetype that you think have really made a difference, send us your deck list and send us an email explaining your deck and why you think we should try it out, and we're really looking forward to trying out some ideas from the community.
Yeah, it's a great way to flex your deck building muscles and maybe build something that you might not have thought of before.
That's about all we have time for this week. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can hit us up on Twitter at Winning Agenda. Check us out on Facebook. Our like page is The Winning Agenda. Or you can shoot us an email at thewinningagenda@gmail.com. Until then, we'll be back next week. See you guys. Thanks for having us.
Ta-ta. Take it easy.
Thanks.
Thanks.